And welcome back to the second half of this week's Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us, Laura Carruthers-Graham. She is Deputy Director for Community Legal Aid Society in Delaware, obviously. Let's talk a little bit about the immigration issue. When you talk about a vulnerable population and a population that is as divorced from recourse as any you can name, do you want to talk about CLASI and this?
Absolutely. And so we receive clients with immigration issues, as you mentioned, through our MLP from our partners. But separate and apart from our MLP, we have a separate immigration program funded by some federal grants to work with non-citizen survivors. So generally what that means is we provide representation for non-citizens on things like a U visa, and that's the letter U, and that's available to victims of crime in the United States who have been cooperative with law enforcement or the prosecution. T visas, the letter T, for victims of human trafficking who are in the United States because they're a victim of sex or labor trafficking, and they've also cooperated with law enforcement or the prosecution. VAWA, or the Violence Against Women Act relief, which is available to not just women, but individuals who have been victimized by a spouse or by another immediate family member and can't petition for status on their own. And then the last type of matter that we generally handle is called Special Immigrant Juvenile Status, or SIJS, which is available to youth who have been brought to the United States and they've either been abandoned, abused, or neglected by one or both of their parents. And the Delaware Juvenile Court feels that it's in their best interest to remain here. So we really help the most vulnerable of Delaware immigrants with these four main types of cases. And prior to the pandemic, we had a fairly robust program where we certainly weren't wanting for cases. And, you know, when the pandemic hit in March, we've seen a decline in cases. And I think that's for a couple of reasons or stems from a few sources. You know, one, I think many of our immigration clients contact us by walking in. It's word of mouth, and they just walk into our brick and mortar office. And being closed to intake, in-person intake, has hampered that a bit. So we've seen a drop off in how we get cases. But I also think that decline in cases is due to the current environment that has been created by the federal administration, that for the past 3.5 years, and exacerbated, in my opinion, during the pandemic, has created fear in the non-citizen community. You know, there are various policies and rules prior to the pandemic, as well as in the pandemic, that have exacerbated our clients' fears for reaching out, associating us with the system, quote unquote, and being afraid to reach out for services. Being worried that getting services from a free legal services agency like CLASI will deem them a public charge because of the new public charge rule. So reaching out for that assistance has really declined, and that concerns us because we know that there are non-citizens and their families who need our help and would qualify for our help, and they're just not getting to us.
Let's discuss programming that is always in the news. Start with DACA. Go
yes.
There. Let's start there.
It's been a, for lack of a better word, busy couple of months. There are lots of immigration policies that have come out that are impacting Delawareans who are non-citizens. And just to give your listeners a little bit of background, about 9% of Delaware's population was born in another country. So that's roughly 91,000 folks who were born somewhere else but are now living in Delaware and calling Delaware home. Another 9%, so a little over 86,000 people living in Delaware are native-born U.S. citizens, so people who were born here in the United States, but they have at least one non-citizen parent. So it's not an insignificant number of us here in Delaware who either ourselves are immigrants or are related to or children of immigrants. DACA is one immigration policy. DACA is short for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This was a program created by executive order by President Obama back in 2012. The idea being that the DREAM Act didn't pass, but the administration wanted to protect undocumented children and youth who were brought to the United States as a child from deportation or from removal from this country. In addition to that protection, it also gave the recipients a temporary work permit known as an employment authorization document, which they could renew every 2 years, and that allows you to get a Social Security number so you can work and pay taxes above the table. And it also allows you to get a driver's license or a state ID. So again, those were two-year work permits, but this was nothing that was a long-term status or path to citizenship. Roughly 650,000 people have DACA nationwide. In Delaware, it's a little over 1,500 individuals who hold DACA status. So a little over 3 years ago, in September of 2017, the current administration terminated DACA. And then what happened was several lawsuits ensued. All of those lawsuits were consolidated and argued before the Supreme Court back in November of last year. And the Supreme Court issued a decision this past June, so on June 18th of 2000. And what the Supreme Court found was that the current administration terminated DACA improperly. So what they did was they terminated or did away and vacated the September 2017 decision by President Trump. Terminating DACA status, which meant it restored former President Obama's 2012 program, which was great news for many 650,000 individuals across the country with this status, knowing that they had at least some sort of temporary security. Unfortunately, about a month after that, the acting Homeland Security Secretary, which is the administration that runs the DACA program, issued a memorandum limiting the program again in three significant ways. First, it said that people who didn't have DACA before it was terminated could not submit new applications. So anyone who kind of didn't jump on the DACA bandwagon before it was terminated can't now get in on that benefit. Second, it eliminated the ability for people who have DACA from applying for what's called advanced parole, which is a bit of an odd phrase, but it's essentially a travel permit that the federal government gives someone to exit and enter the country in certain circumstances. So the current administration, by this memo in July, after the Supreme Court decision, indicated they will not issue these advance parole or travel permit documents to people having DACA unless it is a extreme exceptional circumstance, meaning they're in the military and need to travel, or they need to obtain life-sustaining medical treatment somewhere outside the country, or if it's for immediate safety or family needs. So very, very limited abilities for these individuals. And then the third thing that this memo changed was, I mentioned earlier, the work permits were valid for 2 years. So every 2 years you apply to get your work permit renewed. This memo changed it to 1 year. So now every year I've got to submit an application to renew my work permit, which to many people doesn't sound onerous, but it in fact is. It's an 8-page application. It costs close to $500, and it takes about 5 to 6 months to process. So you... In being forced to renew this every year, you're always in a state of renewal, essentially. So it really is cost prohibitive for working class individuals to do this. So that was kind of the groundbreaking decision, and then the, some would argue, clawback of the decision by the administration that happened this summer with DACA.
And of course, the youth that are in DACA, they self-identified and stepped forward.
Absolutely.
So they are identifiable.
Yes, the U.S. government has their name, their address history, their date of birth, their biometric data, so their fingerprints, a picture, a digital signature. That information is all held by the federal government.
Well, let's move right along. Speaking of information about us and the federal government, census.
Yes. So the census is another kind of hot topic, if you will, that touches on immigration right now. So as you know, the census is taken. It's a constitutional requirement every 10 years. And the data that is collected about who is living among us is used for various things, for things like determining how many representatives a state has in Congress, to determining how much funding the state will get from the federal government for things like federal emergencies, things like hurricanes, and or things like Medicaid and Child Health Insurance Program. Those are block grants that are given to states by the federal government based on the population. So it's really important from a democracy standpoint. This determines how many voices we get in Congress, but it also determines how much money the state gets to provide services to Delawareans. You know, the census is taking place right now. We're in 2020, so it's a census year, and obviously it's been hampered collecting that data because of the coronavirus for safety reasons. But an additional impact on the census has been the current administration's desire and push to add citizenship questions to the census. They pushed that in 2019, and the Supreme Court blocked them asking people, you know, what's your status? Are you legal here? Because that was found to be something that would hinder individuals from participating and not give us a clear count. Back in July of this summer, the current administration issued another memo related to the census taking, arguing that the census requires all inhabitants of a state to be counted and that they are defining inhabitant. They have the discretion to define inhabitant as someone who is not an undocumented immigrant. Some constitutional experts, I'm not one of those, but I agree with them, would argue that the Constitution requires the government to conduct an actual enumeration of the people in the United States without distinguishing whether they are a citizen, someone with a green card, someone with temporary status, or someone who's undocumented. So as with DACA, lawsuits ensued. That's why we have our court system. And there was a case that came out of the U.S. District Court in New York rejecting this exclusion, saying that this is unconstitutional and it violates the requirement that whole people be counted in each state. That is on appeal to the Supreme Court by the federal government. Then subsequent to that, the Census Bureau argued that they will stop census taking early. So they issued a memo saying that they were going to wrap things up last week, September 30th. An injunction came out of a district court in California on the 24th saying that they cannot speed up this plan to end census taking and that it needs to continue. So that's currently being dealt with in the district court, in a district court in California.
We are recording this on the 7th of October.
So how does all this impact immigrants in Delaware? I think people are afraid. They don't want to speak to this is the federal government knocking on their door or sending them a postcard or asking them to fill out a survey online about who they are and where they live and who's in their household and what languages they speak. And that's a lot of identifying information. And I think people are scared and unwilling to participate for valid concerns in the census. And that hurts us as a state. So it's concerning that chilling effect that the census policies have had on this happening in Delaware.
Before we go on, if you are just joining us, I'm Laura Lewis, and with me today, Laura Carruthers-Graham. She is Deputy Director for Community Legal Aid Society, and if you would like to reach out to them, go to declassy.org. D-E for Delaware, C-L-A-S-I, declassy.org. We've been talking about the census. Let's go with the CARE Act. Let's go from there.
Yeah, so the CARES Act has also impacted our Delaware families who are either immigrants or have mixed status, meaning families where some individuals are U.S. citizens and others have non-citizen status. So the CARES Act, or the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act, was the stimulus bill passed back in March and signed into law on March 27th, which essentially provided $2.2 trillion to Americans and small businesses to deal with the fallout economically of COVID-19. The people who did not get to benefit from their stimulus check, which were these $1,200 per person and $500 per child checks that went out to certain households below an income threshold, the families who didn't benefit from this much needed stimulus were mixed status families. So if you are in a family where not every single member of the household has lawful status, as listed on the most recent federal income tax return, you don't get any stimulus. So just to give an example, if let's say I'm in the U.S. military and my spouse is a non-citizen and I'm in the process of petitioning for him or her, and we have three U.S. citizen children. So we're a household of five. We should be getting a stimulus check, but because my spouse does not have a social security number, we get zero. We get nothing. And that has left many of the most vulnerable immigrant families without the stimulus and without the financial assistance that they needed to get through these past 6.5 months. Several bills have been floated subsequent to the passage of the CARES Act in an attempt to try and include mixed status families, among other things. But Congress went into recess before anything could get passed. And then just on the 6th of October, the executive branch announced that they were ending talks with congressional Democrats regarding a stimulus package. And that includes any updates to the stimulus package that could include mixed status families. So there are many Delaware families who, because not everyone is a U.S. citizen, are not getting a stimulus check that they very desperately need.
And I must note that we are recording this on the 7th of October. Things change.
They do.
Things change very
quickly. By the minute.
So let's delve into, it's interesting when you talk about, you can be a member of the military and have a non-status spouse. You can own a house, et cetera, et cetera. Mixed families are quite the conundrum because, again, some qualify for programs. In other cases, it might completely eliminate you as here, but they are paying taxes and hard to identify unless they step forward and identify themselves.
No, and I think, too, a lot of us are guilty of getting caught in the idea that we picture an immigrant as this kind of monolith or this one faceted idea. And, you know, non-citizens are all around us. These are people with whom we work, with whom we worship, with whom our children attend school, our neighbors. So I would encourage listeners to really recognize that, you know, someone who is undocumented or wasn't born here but has status, you know, may look like you, may sound like you. It's not everybody is from a certain country or speaks a certain language. Just to be open to that. But yes, there are many families with mixed status within the family that aren't able to avail themselves to benefits that other families can.
And of course, oh, well, then you should apply, et cetera, and on and on. And yes, you should. However, I do want to ask about, it's expensive. When you mentioned $500 for the work permit and you're in a constant state of applying for the DACA kids, it's very expensive to become a citizen.
It's absolutely, and that's the last step in the long list of steps that individuals must take to get to the United States and get status. Honestly, if it were just as easy as getting in line and filling out an application, I know hundreds of my clients that would have done that already. you have to have a basis to apply. You have to fill out sometimes a 20-plus page application in legalese and submit that. The fees, which I'll get to here in a moment, are particularly burdensome for many families, whether low income or middle income. And the wait times, the length of time or the length of the line in which one must stand to get status can be years, if not decades. So it's really not as simple as some would have us believe to get status in the United States. With the fees in particular, immigration or the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, which is the administrative agency under Homeland Security that receives these types of applications, published a final rule in August that was scheduled to take effect last Friday, October 2nd, announcing that they were changing two things. One, they were changing their fee schedule, and not shockingly, it was an increase in fees. They were not decreasing their fees. And two, they were changing the process and the rules by which one can request what's called a fee waiver, meaning if you are low income and below a threshold, if you prove that, you can ask them to not make you pay the filing fees. So they changed the amounts and they changed the rules by which one can request a waiver of paying the fees. This rule was blocked last week by a federal court, and litigation is pending. So the implementation of this rule that was scheduled to take effect on October 2nd has been stayed by a federal court. So hopefully by the next time I'm on the show, I can give you a good news update on that.
If you are extremely wealthy, you can still buy your way in, though.
You can. There are investor visas, and those are not my clients. You would not
want to meet one.
Yes, those are not the people with whom Classy works. But just to give folks an idea, for someone with a green card or a permanent resident card, if they want to apply for citizenship, they have to submit the application. They have to pass a background check and a character check. They have to pass an English and a civics test, and they have to pay the filing fee. So the prior and still current fee for a citizenship application is $640. The proposed rule was proposing to increase that by 83% up to the cost of $1,170. And that's not insignificant. That's a large amount of money for many folks. Other significant application fees that had were proposed to go up. The work permit fee was proposed to go up from $410 to $550. Some of the petitions related to U visa petitioners, so individuals who are crime victims, who have worked with the U.S. government in investigating and prosecuting the crimes against them. Some of their fees went up from $930, which is what they are currently, to up to $1,400. So that's a 51% increase. These are significant costs for many vulnerable individuals. And while the prior rule, which again is still in effect now, allows for fee waivers for individuals who are at or below 150% of the federal poverty level, the proposed change is to reduce that to people who are at or below 125%, or people who can show that they have an extreme or urgent need to not be able to pay the fees. So it's really increasing the burden of proof and the standard for individuals who are low income to even try and request a waiver of the fees.
Going to ask something we have not heard so much about in recent months, and that is enforcement, detention and enforcement.
Yes, so it's continuing despite the coronavirus. There have been announcements as recently as last week that ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is the enforcement branch of the Department of Homeland Security is going to increase enforcement in cities that are identified as sanctuary cities, which they're defining as state or local government agencies that refuse to hand over individuals to the federal government who identify as being undocumented. Which, you know, anytime there's an announcement that, you know, raids or an enforcement is coming, there is a huge influx of worried clients contacting us. There's just huge fear in the community about even going out and about because you're afraid that you're going to be arrested and detained by ICE. The current administration for the past 3.5 years has prioritized essentially everyone. Prior administrations, and I'm not just speaking of the Obama administration, I'm also talking about George Bush's administration, prioritized the seeking out and detention of individuals who, of non-citizens who had been convicted of significant crimes, individuals who were known terrorists or had known associations with gangs or other gang affiliations. They were really looking for the dangerous people who some would argue don't deserve to be here because they've been convicted or been affiliated with groups. The current administration shifted rather heavily down the spectrum from that and indicated that essentially everyone is a priority. If you are undocumented, even if you have not been convicted of anything, you are a priority. So it's a much wider net that's being cast. Obviously, when individuals are detained, arrested and detained by immigration, they can be held in immigration facilities. And a lot of the concern that advocates have is about the safety and the monitoring of those facilities during a pandemic. You know, what safety precautions are being instilled to protect the detainees? Are they being tested? Are they being allowed access to counsel and to medical staff? So it's concerning that individuals are being held in detention centers where they may not be tested for COVID.
Let's wrap this up. We are actually out of time, and we just got started. But let's very briefly, and I mean very briefly, let's hit upon what the services are that CLASI offers, and when you do how you interact with the immigrant population of Delaware.
Absolutely. So CLASI has some federal grants to provide services to vulnerable immigrants in Delaware. So that is representing survivors of kind of bad acts. So that's on things like a U visa available to victims of crime who cooperate with the federal, with state and local government on the investigation and prosecution. T visas available to survivors of human trafficking who cooperate with the investigation. Violence Against Women Act relief, which is not available to just women. It's available to both genders. Individuals who are victims of family violence, where that family member is a citizen or resident and won't petition for them. Or Special Immigrant Juvenile Status, or SIJS, which is available to abused, abandoned, or neglected children who the family court deems it is in their best interest to remain in the United States. And we provide free legal services to individuals on those main case type areas. And Laura, I will say we are not affiliated with the federal government. We are a nonprofit law firm. And that means our services are completely free. They're completely confidential, importantly. And it's safe for individuals to reach out to us and talk with us and get advice about their immigration matter.
And it is confidential.
Absolutely.
And free. I love that word, free. and I'm going to assume multiple languages?
Absolutely. I mean, not only is providing language access to our limited English proficient clientele the right thing to do, it's also federally mandated. We receive federal grants, and we have to provide adequate language access to our clients. So if we don't have someone on staff who's fluent, we contract with other services to make sure that we are able to effectively communicate with our clients.
And of course, to reach out to CLASI, go to declasi.org. That's DECLASI, declasi.org. Community Legal Aid Society on on Facebook, and on Twitter, it is at DE Classy. My guest today, Laura Graham, she is Deputy Director of Community Legal Aid Society, Incorporated of Delaware. Again, declassy.org. Always great to have you in here. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.